Welcome to Book City Roanoke. I'm Douglas Jackson, and I'm happy today to kick off episode 4 of the podcast's first season with Marissa Mazek Blankenship. But before we start the conversation, I want to tell you a little bit about the podcast. Very importantly, it's brought to you by our founding sponsor, Book No Further, Roanoke's independent bookstore, putting ideas in your head since 2017 down on the Roanoke City Market. We're recording at CoLab Roanoke, and CoLab director and voracious reader Brad Stevens is providing production support as we get this thing up and running. As for format, I'll be speaking with writers, readers, and what we call city builders, people shaping lives and community through literacy and literary efforts here in the Roanoke region. We'll check in with book clubs, and we'll hear from local leaders on the books they're reading. Book City Roanoke is a lab for the exploration of engagement and equity at the intersection of books and place. Explore our things literary at bookcityroanoke.com. And this season of the podcast, we're focused on the theme of identity and action, how the written word helps us shape our understanding of ourselves, and then how we put that action into action in the world around us. Today's guest, Marissa Mazek Blankenship, has organized her life around the written word. A native of New York, she's worked in literacy in New York City. She has a master's in fine arts and creative writing from Hollins University, and she currently works for Roanoke Public Libraries, where she coordinates the collaborative Star City Reads effort. So, Marissa, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me dive right into it. How do books help us become the people we are?
How don't they help us become the people we are? No, but I really do believe very firmly in the power of books to not only change lives, but to really shape them and to transform them. I think that what we read, especially at a young age, shapes our perceptions of the world, right? It shapes how we interact with others. They shape how we think about ourselves. I think books really are everything.
So what's a book that helped shape you at a young age?
Oh, gosh. How young are we talking?
Well, it could be. I think you're still pretty young, so it could be any age.
Probably when I was about 15, I read Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses, and that book just completely knocked me over because I didn't realize that books could do all of the things that that book does. I just sort of read it because I'd heard it was controversial and that seemed interesting. But just structurally and in terms of voice and language, it really, like, my copy is dog-eared and underlined, you know, from things that when I was 15, I thought were just mind-blowing. And I'd say it still is, you know, one of those seminal books. And when I look back, the year I was like 15, 16, I read Rushdie, I read Dostoevsky, I read Tolstoy, I read Garcia Marquez, and just all of those authors really shaped my understanding of the world at such a crucial age.
Wow. Did you come from a family of readers?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah, some of my earliest memories are sitting at the breakfast table and my parents and I all ignoring each other because they would read the New York Times every single morning, which I still do to this day, just online. And we would have the newspaper spread out everywhere. And I can remember starting with the weather section at 5 years old and not understanding that the forecast for Nassau was the Bahamas and not Nassau County, New York. But, you know, I thought, well, this is what you do. So that was what I did.
Terrific. So they're pretty proud of you now.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah. And how do you, like I said, you've kind of organized your life around the written word. How did some of those books that you read at a critical age, how have those shaped the way you act in the world?
I don't know that I've ever thought about it that directly before, but I think that I just remember, you know, being a teenager and trying to figure out who I was and all that good stuff, and just knowing that books had provided me with so much comfort and so much information, and just, you know, I might as well just be hugging a book right now because that's how I walk through the world, and knowing that I wanted to do something with that. And in college, I was very focused on writing and majored in it and yada yada. But then also in college, I came to realize that not everybody had the experiences that I had or the access to resources like these amazing books or other opportunities that my family was able to give me. And I started thinking about, well, where does this come from? And I realized a lot of it came from education and what sort of education I had received on Long Island versus kids in the Bronx half an hour away, what they were getting. So I dove into that and spent a few years too focused on the work I was doing, though it was great, but sort of letting my love of books slide. So then the goal kind of became, well, how can I do both, right? How can I love books and actively be involved in the literary life and also do some good as well in the community beyond what would be available to people like me who are going to be, you know, in the literary world. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Oh, no, it sure does. Yeah. So you're a very active reader mm-hmm. and have been such from a
forever. Yeah.
And you've worked in literacy mm-hmm. and getting books in the hands of young people.
Yep.
And you also write, right? Mm-hmm.
Sometimes.
So, yeah. How do you see writing come into play with that kind of formation of identity?
I know some writers definitely disagree with this, but for me, I write to think through things. Like, I'm a terrible conversational speaker because I want to edit myself and sort of figure out what's my argument actually here. So I've always found myself, even at a young age, going to write something down, whether it was just, you know, thinking I could be the next Anne Frank or, you know, writing in my diary to exploring issues of generational issues in my family today. You know, it just, that's how I think. Mm-hmm. And I'd be a very different person without that. I'd certainly be a less happy person, even though writing is sometimes miserable, as we all know.
But let's talk a little bit about the work you're doing here in Roanoke.
Sure.
The city of Roanoke was recently inducted into the League of Cities Hall of Fame. I think the first city inducted
yep.
in the Hall
first
of Fame.
First ever.
And that was really for the work of Star City Reads. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Sure. So it's not just Star City Reads. It's really a collaborative program with the libraries leading it and Feeding America Southwest Virginia being an absolutely crucial partner in this. Basically, to backtrack a little bit, in 2012, we won the All-America City Award for our plan to improve third grade reading. And then we realized, oh, we have to do this now. And it became the Star City Reads Initiative. We started off with 7 partners led by the libraries. And we sort of thought like, oh, great, we'll give books to kids. That'll be nice. That'll help. Hooray. And it's really, really good work. But what it's turned into over the last few years is an understanding that so many factors impact a child's ability to read beyond their access to books and what's happening in the classroom. But are they getting to school? What's happening at home? Are they healthy? You know, what all of the other things that form a child really do affect their literacy development. And one thing as the libraries as a whole were developing this consciousness that happened was we started realizing that kids were coming into the library, especially over breaks from school, and staying all day, which is great. But they didn't have a lunch. They didn't have snacks. They didn't have money to go get something. So they would just sit all day in the library, you know, and not eat. And we realized, well, we can't have that happen, you know, that it's just unacceptable. So in 2014, we started feeding free lunches at one library branch and expanded it over the next couple of years to every library branch, and then have added after school service. That's new this year. So we now feed kids at 3 o'clock every day when they get out of school and on Saturdays too. Over the summer, we have lunches every day. And, you know, we hope that we can, by feeding children, can help their brain development stay on track, right? And can help them retain some of that knowledge that they've gained over the school year. There are already so many statistics about how children, especially low-income children, lose what they've learned over the summer, especially if they don't have access to enriching programs, but even more so if they're not fed, you know, right? You think of Maslow's hierarchy and being fed is at the very bottom of the pyramid. There's no way our kids can develop fully if they're hungry. So we've been doing that since 2014. It's been really successful. We've served over 50,000 meals. So that doesn't necessarily mean 50,000 kids. It's a lot of repeat kids. But we like to think that that's 50,000 times that we've made some sort of difference in a kid's life. And the National Civic League was kind enough to recognize us as the first Hall of Fame winner because this work only started because of that first All-America City Award. And that's really what they're looking for, is how those awards have then spurred these sorts of programs. So my bosses were in Denver over the weekend getting the award.
Terrific. Well, congratulations on it. And I know that as you're trying to create some collective impact across these all the partner organizations, mm-hmm. you're being very thoughtful about how you measure
yes.
whether or not you're actually making a difference. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the measurement.
Yeah, so I think measurement is really crucial in making sure that we're actually making progress, right? We can feel really good about what we're doing, and there are certain things that can't really be measured. Like I would argue that the impact of a book on a kid, there's no quantitative scale for that unless somebody comes up with one. But we work very closely with we're at something like 32 partners now across the city. And we work with them to collect whatever data we can. So from the schools, we're very lucky to have a partnership with the schools where they will share data with us. So we can look at SOL pass rates and PALS exam pass rates for the younger kids. We track the number of meals we serve. We track program participation. We track the books we're distributing. And we're really hoping that all of this work, you know, focused around books and starting with books, but now encompassing health and dental needs and after school and transportation will all collectively work to help make our kids better readers and hopefully stronger people.
Great. And I know one thing you measure are how many books you've gotten in the hands
yes.
of families and young people. Since you've started, how many books have you distributed?
Over 100,000. Mm-hmm. This past fiscal year that's wrapping up now, we did about 17,000 alone.
Terrific.
So, yeah.
How are some of the ways you're getting those in families' homes and in kids' hands?
Lots of ways. Our signature Star City Reads program is the volunteer Star City Readers who go into schools. This year, it's every preschool class at the Roanoke City Public Schools and read books to kids once a month and then give them books. So I order the books. I like to say it's the easiest volunteer gig ever. You just handed a bag of books and say, you know, go read to these kids. So we give out about 615 books a month through that program. And that's the same kids each month for the school year. So those kids all have 9 books by the end of the school year that they otherwise might not have. We do a lot of outreach events. So I've been at an event every single weekend this month, you know, community festivals, big library programs, neighborhood events, giving out books to kids. You know, we really try to go to where kids are. Because we know not everybody has the sort of access to transportation or other things that they might need to actually come to a library or come to an event on another side of town. So we try to be very conscious about that. Our partners also do amazing work. Turn the Page, for example, does books and breakfast at 2 elementary schools. So they give out books to kids twice a month at each of those schools. So they gave out a couple thousand books this year themselves. Chip gives out books at every home visit. New partnership we have is the Virginia Department of Health, so they have books in their waiting rooms now that kids can take. We have them on the buses with Valley Metro. So we're always trying to think about where kids and their families are and how can we put books there. So I'm always looking for more ways to do that. We have a partnership with public housing, and we're always especially thinking of where the most vulnerable kids, because we want to make sure that they're getting access to new high-quality books.
Great. We've talked a little bit about data and the partnerships. And in a second, I want to ask you about some stories, maybe some instances where you really feel like this work's making a difference in lives. But first, I'm Douglas Jackson, and you're in Book City, Roanoke, exploring equity and engagement at the intersection of books and place. We're speaking today with Marissa Mazek-Blankenship, coordinator of the collaborative Star City Reads. And we're brought to you by our sponsor, Book No Further, on Roanoke's historic market. Stop by and visit with proprietor Dolores Vest, check out her well-curated assemblage of new and gently used books, and perhaps arrange a discount for the purchase of books for your next book club. So, Marissa, let's hear a story or two.
Sure. I think one story, and it's not really one particular, but rather a repeating instance that I've noticed, is how excited the kids who are participating in the volunteer program get when their readers come to visit. So I volunteered my husband a couple years ago that he had to come read to a class with me every month. And the first couple times you visit, especially kindergarten and now we're reading to preschoolers, they're not totally certain, like, what is this? You know, they're still adjusting to the school, and then here come some strangers with a bag of books. But after a couple months, you really see the kids get it. And we come in the room, and it's so funny because they can never say Marissa, but they always remember Bobby. So we come in, they're like, Bobby, what books do you have? every single time, you know, and just the fact that they get so excited. And I've seen that in other classes I've read too, and heard that from my volunteers time and time again. So just knowing, you know, that they're excited about what's the new book we're going to get. And then I think also just going to different festivals and seeing kids really get excited when they see a book they like, or that they're excited about, or a book that their parents are excited about. I was doing a distribution at the Public Housing Authority, Roanoke Redevelopment and Housing Authority, had a Book Rich Environments event a couple weekends ago, and we had a board book called Dream Big, Little One, and it's about different African-American women and, you know, who they were as girls and who they grew up to become. And this one mom was like, oh, yes, we need that for sure, and, like, took it right away, you know, or kids love the superhero books, you know, anything that really inspires them. It's always fun to see that light go on when they see, like, Captain Marvel, that book's for me, you know, or yes, another Pete the Cat. So I don't know that I have a ton of specific stories, but there are just so many instances like that.
Terrific. We were having a book club meeting in the main library, and there's a young boy there, and I was looking at the books with him, and he really responded to Pete the Cat.
They love so Pete the Cat.
I sat down and read him Pete the Cat.
Aww.
But I had not been introduced to Pete the Cat before. What is it about Pete the Cat that they're responding to?
Well, it's so interesting because of the picture book authors that I really love, I wouldn't say that those books are my favorite, Dean and Litwin. I really love Todd Parr. And I thought, like, oh, the kids are going to love these Todd Parr books because all of his characters are, like, different colors. Like, people are orange and purple and have, you know, wacky hair. And nobody's ever a certain, like, race or age or size or anything. I'm like, this is super cool. The kids are going to love it. But they don't, you know, like, they're like, okay, great. But Pete the Cat, I haven't quite figured it out. But if I could give out Pete the Cat books every month, the kids would be thrilled, you know, because I think it's because they're fun and they're relaxed, and there is always a moral there at the end, right? Of like, it's all good. You're going to be okay. Every single time I pull a Pete the Cat book out of my bag, like, Pete the Cat, Pete the Cat, you know, and luckily for me, there are a lot of Pete the Cat books.
And would they mind it if they read the same one several times?
Occasionally I'll get I've read that before, you mm-hmm. know, but for the most part they don't mind. And, you know, I always try to say, like, oh, if you know this book already, you can help, mm-hmm. you know, and then they like to read along with me or take a lead on the song parts or that sort of thing.
Well, with Star City Reads now, you're over 30 partners. Mm-hmm. You're seeing progress.
Yep.
Expanding the meals that are being fed, mm-hmm. And measuring impacts both with health and their feeling of safety in their home. And what's next for the collaborative?
I think a couple of things are next. I think that for one, we're going to continue doing what we're doing. And like I said earlier, always looking for those new partners and new avenues to get books to kids who we haven't yet reached. But I would really love to see our coalition continuing the conversation that we've been having about family engagement and making sure that families feel empowered to read with their kids if they're able, or if they're not, to, you know, get connected to adult literacy classes, or to get connected to the services they might need or want. And that's something I would love to really, you know, become more parent-powered and parent-driven as we go forward. Maybe get some parents, you know, on in some of our meetings even would be great. And I also think that as we've gained this new awareness around all of the factors that affect children's lives, I think we're shifting towards a structural look at poverty itself, you know, right? It's not just about the reading anymore, but we've learned all of these other things that affect kids, and I don't think we'll be able to just kind of sit by and be like, oh yeah, we know that's happening, but we're going to focus on books, right? Like, we're already not doing that. We're already feeding kids. So I would love to see more work in that regard, and I don't quite know what that will look like. There are other communities around the country starting the same kind of conversation. So we'll see where it goes. Always onward.
Who are some of your peer communities across the country doing this work?
There are a lot. There are 400, actually, or a little mm-hmm. bit over 400 now. Some of my favorites as far as the quality of the work they're doing are Kansas City. There's a collective down in Florida of a couple communities called the Suncoast Campaign for Grade Level Reading. Tahoe Truckee out in California. I mean, it's literally, there are stars all over the map, except in a couple of states. There's even a community in Canada. So it's really become a national conversation, just, and even that's evolved over the last couple of years to just be bigger and bigger.
Great. And I can imagine when you start to look at the system of factors that impact a child's life mm-hmm. and a family in the community, it does. You keep branching out
yep.
and addressing other factors. And you can imagine in some cases pushback, folks saying, oh, well, your institution is focused on X mm-hmm. or you're focused on Y. Are you going to limit your resources? Are you going to use your resources ineffectively by addressing such a big challenge? Have you felt any of that pushback? Or
we really haven't. We're really lucky here in Roanoke, and I find that we're always explaining this at conferences, that for whatever reason, Roanoke is just different, you know, in that people are really willing to work together. And I wasn't with Star City Reads at the beginning of our work back in 2012, but it sounds like even then, you know, people were like helping kids, you know, we'll be on board. There's just not that level of siloing that I've definitely heard about in other communities. And I think that our program lead, our libraries director, Sheila Umberger, has really set that tone by saying, you know, yes, we're the libraries. Yes, we have books and computers and movies, but we're also going to have a physical, you know, fitness program for adults, you know, or we're also going to feed kids, or we're also going to do this, you know. So she's so collaborative and welcoming of other work, because at the end of the day, her goal is to help the kids. And I think that has really set the tone for the community, you know, and for other partners to approach us and for us to approach other people. So yeah, I don't think I've gotten any pushback yet.
Terrific. And a little bit more about your personal background. You came to Roanoke mm-hmm. To attend Holland's Creative
yes.
Writing Program.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still here.
I am still here. It's quite the surprise.
Yeah. How many years later? How long have you been here altogether?
I've been here 6 years now. And uh-huh. if you had told me that 6 years ago, I would have laughed in your face. I was so New York focused. Mm-hmm. that I thought, you know, I would be back every long weekend and out of here as quick as I could. But pretty much the moment I arrived, I felt really comfortable here. My family is from Salem, so I grew up being like, oh, I'm never going to live in Salem. My family's from there, you know. And now here I am, you know, really, really happy to be in Roanoke. And I think that was because of the community and people were so welcoming. And, you know, then I met the man who's now my husband, and it all has worked really well.
Well, it struck me when you were talking about your peer communities, most of the communities that you mentioned were smaller urban areas, mm-hmm. but smaller urban areas.
Yep.
And we're in a point today in our society where so much is focused on the major urban centers in our country. And a lot of younger people think, oh, I need to be in one of those centers mm-hmm. to really make a difference.
No, please
what would
leave.
You tell, yeah, what would you tell them about making a difference in a community like Roanoke?
I would say leave the big cities. Life can be a whole lot better and cheaper. There are definitely some big communities in the campaign, but yeah, I had never thought about that. You know, I want to say there's like a San Antonio or somebody, but it is mostly these not multi-million people communities doing this work. And I think that, you know, I go on Facebook sometimes and see what all my Barnard classmates are doing. They're all making $1 zillion doing whatever and looking cool in their apartments in Brooklyn. And that's great. And I'm happy for them. But I'm most inspired, I'd say, by the people who took what they learned at, you know, at places like Barnard or wherever, and then went somewhere else. I was in a writing class with someone who's now the principal of a charter school in Manchester, New Hampshire. And she is, you know, working her butt off every single day to help those kids. And I just think if you keep, you know, right, there've been articles about how rural communities are losing sort of like the talent, you know, and young people with a lot of energy and drive to these big cities, but then that's just draining everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And I think that before I moved here, I was definitely one of those people who thought New York was the absolute center of the universe and anyone who didn't live in a big city was wrong and they're making a mistake. And that's just so not true. You know, there's so much life to be found in elsewhere and so many good communities and so many good and important causes. And you can really make a measurable change by trying something in a community of our size or smaller in a way that you maybe can't in New York.
Great. Well, that's a terrific note to end on. And thank you for being here in Roanoke and making a difference in our community. That brings us to the end of the episode of Book City Roanoke Identity in Action. Thank you for being here. Thanks for the conversation and the insight. I also want to thank our sponsor, Book No Further, which you can find on Roanoke's Historic City Market or with a .com on the end of it. Read other interviews with city builders like Marissa Mazek Blankenship and learn more about Our Things Literary at bookcityroanoke.com. Join us next time with our guest, Kathy Hankla, the author most recently of Lost Places, as we continue our conversation on identity and action.